Today is Monday, December 4th, 2017. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History. And today we're speaking with Barbara Gay Tidball Cameron and her husband, Kenneth Lincoln Cameron. Barbara goes by Gay, and her name is spelled out B-A-R-B-A-R-A. G-A-Y-T-I-D-B-A-L-L-C-A-M-E-R-O-N, and her husband's nickname is Buzz, B-U-Z-Z, and his name is spelled K-E-N-N-E-T-H-L-I-N-C-O-L-N-C-A-M-E-R-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. So, Gay and Buzz, may I have your permission to record this conversation?
You sure may, Tom.
Yes, Tom, you may.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you so much for your willingness to be interviewed here. This is part one of possibly a multi-part interview. And, Gay, I'd like to start with you. What year were you born and where were you born?
I was born in 1936 in Butte, Montana.
What were your parents doing in Butte?
Actually, they were living 30 miles east of that, over the Continental Divide, in a little town called Whitehall, Montana.
Okay.
My mother was a school teacher. My dad owned his own creamery. And I am an identical twin, 15 minutes younger than my twin.
My.
And our older sister was born in Butte also in 1931. But we were... and grew up in Whitehall.
What's your identical twin's name?
Wanda, W-A-N-D-A, Joe, J-O, Tidball, T-I-D-B-A-L-L, Shellback, S-C-H-E-L-L-B-A-C-H.
Thank you. And your older sister?
Her name is Dawn, D-A-W-N, O, middle initial, Tidball, T-I-D-B-A-L-L, last name Myers, M-Y-E-R-S.
Thank you. Do you have any brothers?
No brothers, just we three girls.
Okay. And how was it that your dad was doing the dairy farming?
He grew up in Whitehall, and I don't know, honestly, if that was just the first job he got in the creamery, but as far as back as I can remember, that's where he worked, and then he bought the ownership of the creamery, which eventually he had a partner named George Hakola. That's G-E-O-R-G-E, Hakola, H-A-K-O-L-A. Whom my dad sold his interest in the creamery to in 1951.
I bet your father knew all about the Babcock milk fat test. It was a simple test to figure out, you know, like 2%, half and half, no fat milk.
Right.
It was a simple test for that, and as a creamery guy, he would have known all about that.
Sure he did.
Sold out in 1951. So did you grow up in Whitehall then?
Yes, we did. We started school there. There was no kindergarten, so we started first grade there. And we stayed in Whitehall until Joe and I were 13 years old. And we moved to Arizona the spring of 1951.
Okay.
We had taken a summer vacation from Montana in 1950, my dad, my mother, and my twin and I, down to Arizona, and my parents fell in love with it and the climate, and they said, let's go back to Montana and sell everything we did and move to Arizona, which is what happened.
My gosh. You know, can you tell me a little bit about growing up in Whitehall? What was that like?
It was a very small town. We didn't know that there were big cities around. Everybody knew everybody, but it was a lot of fun. We were involved in all kinds of things. My twin and I were very active in the music department with instruments. We each played three musical instruments, the piano, the violin. I played the clarinet. Joe played saxophone.
Wow.
My mother got us started early when we were about 5 years old.
Wow.
We just had a wonderful growing up childhood, the normal stuff. Rode bikes, got in trouble with the neighbors, and just the normal kid things. But it was a wonderful way to grow up in a small town. What? It was a real education to get out of Whitehall and see that more to the world than just that little dinky town.
You mentioned that summer vacation in 1951. Between 1936, say, and 1950, between when you were born up to 14, did you all the creamery business can be very demanding. I mean, dairy cows need to be milked twice a day. It can be a job that gives you no vacation time at all. But if your father was kind of owning the company, it's possible that he had other people working for him. So my roundabout question is, did you have chances to get away and explore more of the world as children growing up?
The only recollection I have of doing too much exploring is every Sunday, my dad says, we are taking the day off, and we would go out in the hills, we would shoot guns, we would explore mining claims, and invariably, we always got stuck.
Tell me more.
Yeah. We would plan for the whole day outing, and we got to the point where Joe and I would say, Daddy, please don't get stuck. And then we had an old car. I can't even tell you what it was. But, in the Whitehall, the hills of Montana, they were always full of ice and snow for the good part and mud. And we would really get, in trouble. But I remember one time we went out for a Sunday drive and got stuck in a snowbank, and my dad had to walk a mile and a half back to Whitehall to get help.
Wow.
And that was basically our only recreation that we had, other than family picnics and with friends and family and that kind of thing. But no long trips at all. We did go to Yellowstone Park, I remember. I don't even know how old I was. But we saw a few other places like that. There's a hot springs plunge. We call it a plunge, Pipestone Plunge. And we would spend a lot of our summers there in the water. And my older sister, Dawn, worked there when she was in high school, helped the owners, run the plunge and all that. But we just had a really wonderful, normal childhood.
Tell me more about the Pipestone Plunge. I've never heard of it, and I don't know what it is. How would you describe it for me?
It was a hot spring, and it was between Whitehall. Oh, it was probably 10 miles west of Whitehall on your way to Butte.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's still there or not. I don't.
An RV park.
Yeah, there's an RV park. We stayed in that years ago.
So was it people would go to the hot springs just to soak and and sort of medicinal, take a bath? Hot springs are wonderful deals. Or was it were there big swimming pools? What was it like?
Well, it was a pretty good swimming pool, and most of it was just for swimming, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was in a covered Quonset hut.
Huh.
If I remember correctly. And they had showers that you would take before you got in and when you got out.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know as though it was for medicinal purposes as much as it was just for pleasure.
Okay.
We were kids and didn't pay that much attention.
Right. No, no worries. What was your mother's name?
Her full name was Edna Nancy, Nancy, Bolen, Bolen, Tidball.
Thank you. And where was she from?
She was born in a town in North Dakota called Butte. Same town as we were born in, but it's Butte, North Dakota.
Wow. What were her folks doing up there, do you remember?
I really don't remember.
Okay. How did your mom meet your dad?
She and her older sister, who's named Ella G. Bolin, were both school teachers, and Ella G. had moved from North Dakota to Whitehall and got her first teaching job. And 2 years later, my mom graduated from college, and she got her a job in Whitehall, and so my mom moved out to Whitehall.
Wow.
And that's how she met my dad.
Excuse me. Do you know roughly what year that was?
They were married in 1929.
Okay.
June 2nd of 1929.
So I just think about how wonderful it would have been to have a parent who was a teacher who really would have then given their best to their children as a teacher. Did you find that helpful, and were you introduced to reading? You mentioned you were introduced early on to music. It's a wonderful thing.
Oh, yes. Yes. Our mother was a teacher from day one, and cracked the ruler, and she insisted that we do our homework, and she worked with us. She worked, I think, more with our older sister, Dawn, because she was 5 years older than Joe and I.
Okay.
And by the time we came along, she went back to teaching, and she didn't quite have the time to spend with us that she did with Dawn. But she was very much the educator, and we had to crack the mark, or we got in trouble.
Okay. What kind of fun stories can you tell me about your mom?
She never knew a stranger. She talked to everybody in the world.
Never shut her mouth.
She was very opinionated. If she liked you, she liked you. If she didn't like you, you knew it.
Okay.
But she was a fun person, very musically inclined herself, very talented, and she was a wonderful educator. She could take a classroom and get their attention, and everybody just raved about how lucky they were to have her for their teacher.
Nice. And so was she teaching in the school that you went to as a child?
Yes, she was, yeah. It was Whitehall Grade School. It was only one school, and she tried to avoid us as much as she could, thinking that she didn't want to teach us, you know, give us a chance with somebody else. But there were a couple classes I know she had to teach. You know, like when we were in the fourth or fifth grade, they had teachers that roamed or whatever you want to say, and so we had a couple subjects from her. But she was hard on us. We had to do it or we didn't make it.
Okay. Trying to think, any other stories about your dad you want to recollect right now as you were growing up as a child?
He loved to hunt. He was quite an avid hunter and a fisherman, too.
Okay.
That was his one recreation. If he could get away on Sunday or for a half of a Saturday afternoon from the creamery. And every year he would go out and get us a deer and get us an elk most of the time. And the outdoors was his life as much as he could make it.
Nice.
With working. And he was a brilliant man. He graduated valedictorian of his class.
Where?
In Whitehall.
Okay.
Yeah, he was born in Whitehall also and graduated. I don't know how many were in his class, probably not too many. But he had a sister, Josephine, who was 2 years younger, and she grew up in Whitehall, I believe, too, until she got older and got married and moved to Detroit, I believe.
And what was your, do you know what your father's parents were doing in Whitehall?
I really don't.
Okay.
If my memory serves me from listening to them, Dean's father was a mining man, and he ran the lift, that brings the ore and stuff out of the mines, out of shafts.
Sure.
I don't know about his mom.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Okay. All right. Nice. So then, that summer vacation in 1951 was the first time you guys really headed out. any substantial distance away from the from Whitehall where you grew up. Is that right?
You're right. Yeah.
Tell me about that summer vacation in 51. What do you remember about that?
Oh, we didn't know, my twin and I didn't know where Arizona was on the map.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, we took off from Whitehall and ended up, I know we came down through Mesa and went to Phoenix and went through the Capitol. We were amazed at the saguaro cactuses. We didn't know what a saguaro cactus was.
Can you spell that for me?
S-A-G-U-A-R-O.
Thank you.
Saguaro cactus.
Yep.
And I believe that's how you spell it. And we went all over down in this area more than anything.
What do you remember about the roads?
They were narrow, but they were paved.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't remember how long that vacation was, maybe a week at the most. Yeah, maybe 10 days.
And there were five of you in the car?
No, four.
Oh, okay.
Four. Yeah, my dad and mom and my twin and I.
So Dawn didn't go?
No, she graduated whatever 5 years back was from high school, and then she went to nurse's training in Bozeman.
Okay.
And when we moved to Arizona, we left her in Bozeman going to nursing school, and she graduated and got her degree.
Great. All right, so it's you, your twin, and your mom and dad.
Right.
Well, you know, the typical vision of the American family with the kids in the back seat. What else do you remember about that trip?
How hot it was down here in Arizona compared to cold Montana.
Uh-huh.
But we were just, you know, in awe of everything. I don't think we went to see the Grand Canyon on that trip. I don't know why, but I don't remember seeing it, but we just were amazed at all the history or the country here with the plants, and I can't remember where all we went, Tom, but it was exciting for us. We'd never been ventured out of Little Whitehall all our lives, so our eyes were really open.
So let's back up a little bit, because clearly, you know, it sounds to me, if I can be so bold, your parents were fairly smart, fairly intelligent, and I don't get a sense that things were happening kind of off the cuff. It sounds like this was a planned adventure. Was, you know, I just kind of thinking, you know, do you know through the family stories, were your dad and mom kind of discussing, all right, we need to change out of Whitehall. There's more of a world out there than this, and let's go exploring. Do you kind of know how that came about?
Well, I think a good part of it was, and I don't know what even made them want to come to Arizona, but after that trip, they had the bug, we got to get out of cold Montana and move to a warmer climate, and my dad was all for it.
Okay.
Because a working, you know, he'd get up early and go get the milk from the farms and all that, so he froze, I'm sure, for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were just kind of getting tired of the cold, and so we came to Arizona. One of our first stops, I believe, was at Marble Canyon, and that's where they got acquainted first with Lorenzo Hubble, and whoever was running the trading post there said, if you ever want to move, we'll put you to work, and so that's what happened when we first moved down here in 1951. We landed in Marble Canyon, and my dad was a maintenance man for Lorenzo Hubble.
So hang on a second. Let's kind of expand on this a little bit. The summer of 51 was a vacation, and your parents came back to Whitehall and said, that's it, we're packing up, I'm selling out, just like that.
The vacation might have been in 50,
Tom.
Well, I'm sorry. Okay.
No,
that's my fault. Okay.
No, I'm losing track of my years here. But,
got it.
Yeah, probably did that vacation in 50 and then moved in 51.
So on that move in 51, do you remember what time of year it was when you left Whitehall? And what were you thinking as as a teenager now, I'm leaving my friends and my family, and family was with you, but.
Yeah, we were a little upset. We didn't want to leave our friends, of course, and this was in the spring of 1951.
Okay.
And we were freshmen in high school in Whitehall.
Oh.
And
you were going to be freshmen, weren't you?
Or were we in eighth grade? Let me think a minute here, Tom.
No worries.
When we moved from Whitehall, we had 6 weeks left of our freshman year.
Wow.
Eighth grade.
I think it was eighth grade because you spent freshman year here. Or maybe the last 6 weeks of your freshman
year. We had six of the last 6 weeks of our freshman year of high school when we left Whitehall. And we landed in Marble Canyon, where my dad got a maintenance job for Lorenzo Hubble, and my mother helped clean cabins or whatever else she could do to help.
Yep.
So, and when we landed here, we had 6 weeks left of our freshman year of high school to go, and just up the road was another trading post owned and run by Buck and Betty Rogers called Vermilion Cliffs.
Yep.
I believe. And Buck was a white fellow, and Betty was a full-blooded Navajo.
Okay.
And they had five children, and they had a beautiful home in Flagstaff where they all went to school. So my mother, not knowing any strangers, got acquainted with them real well.
Okay.
And Betty and Buck said, your twins can come stay with us for the last 6 weeks and live with us and finish out their freshman year of high school.
Wow.
In Flagstaff. So that's how we did our freshman year.
Wow. What a huge change for you and Wanda.
It was. Yeah. We got acquainted with the Indians.
Yeah. Well, in Flagstaff, mountain town, I'm assuming Whitehall was kind of probably elevation 5,000 feet or so, maybe six.
Right.
And so you weren't too unfamiliar with a mountain town. But the whole thing of mom and dad are sort of out in the desert with Lorenzo, and we're here quite a ways away in Flagstaff trying to meet new kids in your freshman class and dealing with Buck and Betty's children.
Right. The one blessing, Tom, we've always had, Joe and I always had each other, and that was a real blessing.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. What can you tell me about your recollections of those final 6 weeks of being a freshman in what would have been Flagstaff High School?
We were nervous as all get out. We didn't know anybody, whatever. But it didn't take too long till we got acquainted with certain friends, and we got into the band right off the bat, and. We would spend the weekdays living with Betty and her children in the home, and then Buck would come in from Vermilion Cliffs trading post that they had and pick us up every Friday afternoon and take us out, and we would spend the weekend at Marble Canyon with my dad and mom, and then their children would go on to their trading post.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And then he would take us all back on Sunday.
Wow.
And one of the experiences, Buck was a real rough, tough, whatever he was. And I remember, I don't know what the history was at all, but one time we had some Indians come to the door, Indian men come to the front door, and Buck was there, and they got into a huge fist fight. Blood was splattered all over the wall. And my twin Joe was playing Jesus Loves Me on the piano.
Oh, my heavens.
It was a nightmare, free-for-all, and I think the cops were eventually called. I don't know what it was all about, but I'll never forget it.
This was in Flagstaff, at their home in Flag?
Yes, in Buck and Betty's home in Flagstaff.
Oh, my heavens, did you tell your mom and dad about this?
Oh, yes. They were shocked. They didn't know what to do, but they knew we were on the home stretch of school, so if we could wing it out.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
But Buck was the kind of... He was a kind of a fighter. It was either his way or whatever. Nice guy, I think, but but he didn't let anybody tell him what to do or how to do it. And what this was all about, I think these were Navajo men that came to the door. And I think there's some history going on there that, you know, caused all this, so who knows what.
Well, Buck and Betty were way ahead of their time as a mixed-race couple. With children, and I really, you know, laud them for saying, hey, you know, we don't care about that stuff. We're going to hang together as a couple, and it could have been very upsetting to not only Buck's family but Betty's families as well.
Right, that's very true. Yeah, I do remember Betty is the one that pierced our ears one day. They had two daughters and three boys. Buck and Betty had two daughters and three boys.
Okay.
And one time we came home from school, and Betty said, let's get your ears pierced. So we had, you know, pinched our ears and put potatoes on them and whatever, her two daughters and Joe and I. And so I've got pierced ears, and it's because of Betty Rogers.
Well, wait a minute. I'm just thinking about your mom and your dad that are pretty sort of straight, upright kind of folks, and they send you off with these people, and there's fist fights, and you come back with your ears pierced.
I don't think they knew what to think.
This is the Wild West we've sent our children to. Oh, my.
It is.
What do you remember about Lorenzo Hubble?
I don't remember too much. I wasn't around him all that much. I know my parents liked him, and I think he was a matter-of-fact businessman, but my folks got along with him real well. He didn't come out to Marble Canyon too very often.
Can you describe him for me, what you remember?
He was a heavy-set man, if I remember correctly, and very polite. I really didn't pay that much attention to him, Tom, to be that honest with you.
No worries. And then can you describe for me the Marble Canyon Lodge as you remember it at that time?
Okay. It was a nice motel. I can't remember how many cabins they had attached. It was all built with native rock sandstone around it. The cabins were very nice. We had to stay in two different cabins, my folks in one and Joe and I in another, for that 6 weeks and or whatever it was. And then right across the highway was the curio shop and the restaurant. And my mother would go over and help in the curio shop a little bit. And there's a water tank up on the hill that provided the water to the facility.
Uh-huh.
And my dad would have to go up there daily to do something, whatever he did.
Fire up the pump
or whatever he did. But it wasn't a real big, heavy job he did, but he liked it. It was outdoors, and he was very good with machinery.
Well, your dad might have liked it. How did your mom manage?
She liked talking to the people, and of course a lot of tourists would come by, and she would make friends with all the tourists, and she would help rent out the cabins. Maybe she did most of that.
Okay.
And so she kept busy, you know, cleaning cabins, and at that time it was just a little narrow highway going through there, which it probably still is.
That's right.
But she kept busy, but they knew that this wasn't going to go too far, but then they got acquainted with Lorenzo Hubble, and he said, well, I've got an opening to run the trading post in Arrive. And so after we got out freshman year in Flagstaff, my folks and Joe and I moved to Arrive.
So how do you spell Arrive?
O-R-A-B-I?
O-R-A-I-V-I.
And that's in Arizona?
That's on the Hopi Indian Reservation.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just east of Marble Canyon.
Okay.
Southeast.
Right.
That's on the Hopi Reservation.
Yes, I got that. And that's in Arizona. You really didn't get a chance to time. You sort of had weekends, it sounds like, there at Marble Canyon for maybe a month, month and a half, and then fairly quickly moved off to Oraibi? Or did you actually spend that first summer of 1951 there at Marble Canyon Lodge?
No, we moved to Oraibi shortly after we were out of school.
Okay. Because, of course, I'm thinking about the river and river runners that might have been coming through Marble Canyon Lodge, but that I'm sure will come up later down the road, and there's a good chance that quite didn't get into your radar screen in 1951, but I just want to check.
Right. I don't believe it did, Tom.
Okay. Another question I've got about the Marble Canyon Vermilion Cliffs area at the time in 1951. Did Cliff Dwellers Lodge get on your radar screen?
It sure did, with Art Green.
Yes, please, tell me.
Green is G-R-E-E-N-E.
Okay.
And Art was the owner, and I can't think of his wife's name, but he ran Cliff Dwellers.
And he had some daughters as well, didn't he?
You know, I really can't remember. He did have family, and I can't remember how many or where.
Okay. And at that time in 1951, I seem to remember that he had his giant aluminum airboat with a huge engine out the back of it. The airboat that he would take down to Lee's Ferry and put in the water and then drive that thing thundering all the way to Rainbow Bridge. Did that get on your radar screen there in 1951?
No, it did not.
Okay.
I've seen pictures of that, but it wasn't, presented when we were there.
Okay. Do you have any stories? You've said a couple wonderful stories about Buck and Betty Rogers. Any stories about Art Green over at Cliff Dwellers?
We would go up there, my mom and dad and Joe and I would go up and have a Coke late afternoon or something. And of course, my parents would visit with them. My mother and dad got very well acquainted with Art, and they would tell stories. But we were just young girls. We weren't paying too much attention. I really don't recollect, too much out of the ordinary other than having a good time up there with whoever might have been there.
Nice. Fun. Okay. Then let's go to Oraibi.
Okay.
How did you get there? What do you recall about it?
Like I say, Lorenzo Hubble gave my mom and dad a job running that Hubble Trading Post in Oraibi.
This was Oraibi. There are two parts of Oraibi. There's Old Oraibi and New Oraibi. The Old Oraibi was where the trading post was, wasn't it, honey? Yeah. And, the Hopi Indians were a very private type of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they... I don't know whether they, I guess they took to your folks without any problem, but it was very, very primitive, as was Marble Canyon. Marble Canyon at that time, there was no electricity except coal plants and things like that. And I don't know where they, what sort of, you had electricity at Oraibi too, did you?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, and I don't know where they got that.
So how did you, in theory, you loaded up the car again and left Marble Canyon and drove over to Old Oraibi. That would have been down to down to Tuba City or over down toward the Gap. And let's see, is that right? Yeah,
yep.
And then down over to Tuba City and off to points east. Gay, what were you thinking suddenly driving out through the Painted Desert?
Where are we going now? What are we going to do? I think by this time, Joe and I didn't know what was going on with our lives, but we didn't worry about it. We knew we were in good hands with our folks.
Yeah, yeah.
And so anyway, but there was a nice big house right close to, or right attached to the trading post, and that's where we lived. And, of course, it didn't take my mom long at all to get acquainted with all the Hopis, and she soon found out, Tom, that there was a Hopi band, and they would practice 2 or 3 times a week or maybe more.
Wow.
She said, I've got girls that can play instruments. Can they join you? And these men said, of course, and these are all grown married men.
Wow.
And so we soon started practicing with them down in Akiva.
Wow, tell me. So wait. Let's back up a bit before we get to the band in the Kiva. Tell me about the big house next to the trading post. Tell me about the trading post. Tell me about Old Araibi.
You know, I don't remember that much about it, Tom. The house is built, I think, with rock.
Okay.
And I don't remember. It seemed like it was big compared to what we had at Marble Canyon, which was just 2 motels put together.
Yep.
But, and I think I don't believe it was quite attached to the trading post. And I don't remember that much about the trading post either, Tom.
Okay.
It's full of Indian goods, you know, and Indians coming and going all day long. My mother loved it. My dad didn't like it so much. He wasn't an Indian trader. My mom could have taken to it and did, you know. With the Indians, she loved that, but we were not in the trading post that much. Joe and I made our own playtime with some Hopi kids, and you know, just did our own thing as eighth graders do, whatever that was.
Yeah. Let's stop for a minute, because you mentioned that your mom really enjoyed the trading post and your dad not quite so much. Were there a number of tourists coming through Old Araibi at the time? Or was the trading post, as you say, simply set up if I may, here with some generalizations, be sort of the only, if you will, supermarket in town in a small rural community, and it was the place to go for dry goods and foodstuffs and things. It wasn't the trading post we might think of today handcrafted goods for the tourist trade. Can you kind of tell me how the trading post was set up?
I believe it was mostly set up, Tom, for the locals, for the Indians themselves, for a place to go, you know, trade their goods and buy their groceries and all that. I do not remember too many tourists. There were a few, but not very many that I recall. It was mostly for the Indians' well-being, you know, to bring their wares and trade whatever or sell whatever they made and buy their flour and their sugar and whatever else they needed.
So this was a barter, in a way, a barter exchange rate. I can appreciate that might have been very difficult for your father. You know, coming from the creamery business where, okay, you have a set schedule, you pick up the milk, you know, there's some financial trading that happens, but there's not a lot of head scratching to figure out, well, how much is this milk worth today and how many blankets are you going to give me for it? As a barter-based store, that's a fascinating business.
Right, yeah. And I believe that's what it mostly was, Tom, is the Indians coming in every day. And I think we kept it open, maybe not on Sundays, but I think it was open the other days, 6 days of the week.
Okay.
So pretty well tied down. And I think our only day off again was on Sunday.
All right, so now let's wander off to the Kiva. Your mom kind of set you up for this. It doesn't sound like something that you girls went out and figured out. Is that right?
No, we did not even know what a Kiva was. We didn't know what an Indian was.
So talk to me. What do you remember about that first band practice?
It was pretty, we were nervous, you know, but we'd had this musical background. But I remember going down the ladder into this Kiva with our musical instruments, and it was just a big round circle room, and the men were all there, and they said, okay, we want you to join us, you know, whatever. So they set us up with music and all that, and so we started practicing, and I'm sure we practiced 2 or 3 or 4 times a week. And these men, they're grown men, but they were excellent musicians.
Wow.
They didn't miss folk, they didn't do anything. So Joe and I were pretty proud of ourselves that we could keep up with them.
You bet. And what kind of things were you playing?
What kind of instruments?
Well, instruments and then type of music.
Oh, all kinds of music. A lot of marching music. And I was on the clarinet. Joe was on her saxophone.
Okay.
And so we played all kinds of music. I don't remember exactly. But it led us into marching with the Hopi Band in Prescott, Arizona on the 4th of July that year for the Prescott Frontier Days?
Frontier Days, I believe.
Wow.
And we were the only girls and the only whites, and the rest were all Hopi men.
Wow. That's brilliant. This was then in the summer of 1952.
Right, July, in the summer of 52.
Yeah. Tell me, what else do you remember about that?
It was just a fun experience, and I don't know what prompted my folks, but there again, they ran that trading post for probably a couple months, and then there's another Hubble trading post at that time up north of Araby called Pinon, and the people that were running that had to go on went on vacation, and we were up there for, I think, just 6 weeks, maybe a month, not very long. So they went up there, and I don't remember too much about that. It was a pretty fast thing. Actually, it wasn't even 6 weeks. It was more like 2 weeks.
Okay.
And then from there, Lorenzo Hubble offered my folks the job of running the Hubble trading post at Ganado. And so we moved to Ganado that same summer of 52 in August, I believe.
Okay, before we scurry off to Ganado, and by this time you're really starting to get an awareness of high desert country, pinyon and rural remote. Talk about rural remote kind of puts Whitehall to shame.
Right, got that.
But I just kind of don't quite want to leave the girls in the band in the Kiva. I mean, any other stories about that? What other instruments were the men playing? Do you remember?
They were playing all of them. The trumpet, the trombone, all the brass, the clarinet, all the woodwinds. There wasn't one that they weren't playing, Tom. And the drums, you know, they were excellent musicians.
That would have been a crowded Kiva.
It was.
Wow.
But they made room for Joe and I, and like I say, I wish I'd paid more attention to what was in the Kiva besides people.
Well, you couldn't see. I mean, it was just full of people and musical instruments.
I tried, yeah. But every one of those men took Joe and I under their wing, and they just treated us like queens.
Oh, that's wonderful. What were the acoustics like?
Very loud.
I was going to say.
I remember that.
What a wonderful story.
Quite a wonderful experience. We'll never forget it.
I bet. Okay, so now let's shift to Ganado. There's a missionary hospital in Ganado, and the Hubble Trading Post is there. I'm going to back up a second just for the transcribers. Pinyon, I believe that's spelled Pinyon, the Pinyon Trading Post. And then is that right? The Hubble Trading Post was just a mile or so west of the mission hospital area. Is that right?
Are you talking about the Pinyon Trading Post?
No, I'm sorry. I've gone off to Ganado now. I should have told you.
I don't think there was anything there in Ganado at that time, was it?
No, I don't believe so. I've heard it. I know there was a hospital there in Ganado.
Right, the hospital. That's right. Because the hospital was started in the teens or 20s, wasn't it?
You know, I'm not sure it was there, I know.
Right. Run by, I'm trying to remember the religious organization that ran that hospital. It still is connected with it today.
Oh, I don't remember, Tom.
Okay, well, what do you remember then about Ganado?
We moved there, like I say, probably in August of 51. And there again, my mom loved the Navajo. That was on the Navajo reservation. And they ran that trading post. My mom loved the Indians. My dad didn't like them so much. I think it was just a different world for him, and he never really got quite used to it.
Okay.
But they had another caretaker living on a property, and he was a Mexican man with a wife, and they kept having a lot of babies, I remember.
Okay.
They had a horse. And so we would try to ride the horse, and we didn't know what we were doing, so he'd take us under a tree and knock us out.
What a smart horse.
Yeah. Yeah. But I say we were only there about a month before we had to, there again, high school, so we had to find a place to go to high school in Gallup. So my mother being my mother, we went to Gallup, and she got us enrolled, and that would be our sophomore year of high school.
Okay.
I don't know how she found this lady, but her name was Mrs. Pascalone. She was Italian, and I don't know how you spell Pascalone.
Give it a try.
Pascalone.
Thank you. Pascalone. Do you remember her first name?
No, I don't.
Okay. And she had a house there in Gallup that you and Joe were able to room in?
Right. She had a front living room that had a sleeper couch and then a big chair that made out into a bed.
Okay.
And she cooked us wonderful Italian dinners.
Wow.
Yeah. So she was a widow lady, an elderly lady, but she was very nice.
Nice. So Gallup, this would have been now into the fall, late summer 1952. Gallup was on Route 66, is that right?
That's right.
And Route 66 at the time, of course, the train was still really important in the country, but the roads were more and more important now. Do you remember that being a fairly busy town?
Right. It was busy. We thought we'd gone to the city.
Wow. What do you remember about Gallup in as you started your sophomore year in 1952?
We were in awe of the big city, so to speak. But like I said, we were sophomores in high school. Got acquainted there again with the band. And long story short, with the band, we tried out for all-state band, and Joe took first chair for the state of New Mexico with her tenor saxophone.
Wow.
And I came in fifth chair clarinet. But
wow. In the state?
Yeah, in the state.
Well done.
I think we owe a lot of that success to the Hopi band.
Is that right? That's wonderful.
I'm sure we owe it to them.
Why do you say that? Did they give you a confidence in performing?
Oh, they just thought we were wonderful, and they, you know, we played hard music, and you either had to practice and do it, or of course they never said no to us.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they challenged us.
Okay.
And then we were, you know, for my mother from day one, you got to meet the challenges in life.
Nice. What do you remember about traveling then on the music circuit, if you will, to go to the competitions?
Oh, I believe we went with our band instructor from Gallup, and when we went to we had to go over to Albuquerque to try out, and that was just a long day, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
But then, of course, with the Gallup band, we went from, you know, places for high school, you know, with the football season and that kind of thing, just a marching band type thing.
Uh-huh.
And then we put on our concerts, of course, in the wintertime. And there again, I had to try out for for first chair clarinet in the Gallup band, and I competed against seniors and juniors, and I was the only sophomore.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and Joe was the only tenor saxophone that made it. So
that's amazing. I mean, how many other sax players were there?
I think there were two others with the tenor. There were more alto. That's a smaller sax. But the tenor is a little bit bigger instrument.
Okay.
I think there were two others. Of course, there were, probably 15 clarinets.
So as you were getting into the music scene there, were your mom and dad still at Ganado?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. There again, we would catch, there was another girl from Ganado that her folks ran another trading post there in Ganado, and she was the same age we were, and she too had to go to Gallup to go to school, and so our parents would take turns, if they could, coming in on Friday night and picking us all up from high school, taking us back for the weekend, and then one of them or the other would bring us back to Gallup to go to school the next Monday.
What do you recall about your weekends with your family?
Our parents, my mom and dad, were gone most of Saturday in the trading post, and Joe and I would just horse around, play around, whatever we did.
Okay.
Can't remember too much. I think it was in that summer before we went to Gallup that Lorenzo Hubble's son John was there. John Hubble was his name.
Okay.
And we got to playing chess with him, and he was a brilliant, he was a professor, I believe, of a college in back in New York.
Ah.
But we would play chess with him, and we would beat him.
Wow.
We were pretty proud of that, too.
I bet. So I would assume Saturday was a busy day at the trading post.
Yes, it was. One of the busiest, I believe.
What kind of, I'm thinking, what kind of vehicles would the Navajo have come into the trading post with? Were these rubber-tired wagons and horses or automobiles? What were people driving then?
I believe most of it was covered wagon, or maybe not covered, but wagons and horses.
Okay.
And they would have it loaded up with whatever they had, and they would get hay from the barn that was behind the trading post.
Oh, they had feed there as well. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But I believe most of it was all done with horse and wagon.
And were you conversant with how to hook a horse to a wagon? Could you put the pieces all together and figure it out?
No, I didn't even want to try.
Okay, all right. All right.
That didn't interest me at all.
Okay. And then what do you remember about the general school there in Ganado? 52-53.
Actually, you mean Gallup?
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Gallup. Yeah, it was a nice high school, and we got acquainted real well with all kids in our school. And Joe went one way, and she took different classes than I did.
Okay.
Being twins, we wanted to kind of go our separate ways, but I know we both had to take algebra, and she took hers from one teacher, and she said they just played and lit firecrackers and had fun.
Okay.
But it was just a typical high school, but we got acquainted with everybody, and it was enjoyable. And of course, our band was our main goal in life, I think.
Okay. I'm curious, thinking about twins in the American West, it's kind of a novelty. Twins were rarer than they are today. And did you guys get a lot of attention? Were you, there's a 15-minute difference you mentioned, but still, were you identical twins? There's some different types of twins.
Tom, we're identical.
Okay, and did you wear your hair the same and try to wear your clothing the same? Did you play that? Could you confuse people?
Well, we did for a while, and then as we got older, we didn't want to look alike.
Okay.
But my dad never could tell us apart. My mother knew who we were, but when we got in trouble, of course, nobody admitted to anything. So she said, I spanked you both, and that way I made sure I got the right one.
Oh, my gosh. Did you ever play any tricks on anyone with your twinage?
Oh, yeah, we did that. We also played tricks on our husbands. Buzz sitting here and her husband, Don.
Well, before we get there, because I haven't even started in on poor Buzz yet today, tell me some of the tricks you might play there in Gallup. As
yeah.
Twins.
Other than on boyfriends, okay. We would say, let's go, out and get an ice cream or something, so the other one would take its place. Never knew the difference, so we didn't tell them. I can't remember. We were kind of naughty girls, I think. We liked to play tricks.
Well, it sounds like you had a kind of a healthy sense of humor.
Yeah, we did. We did very much.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, and then into the winter. The winters can be kind of tough, cold, and still driving back and forth from Ganado to Gallup on weekends. Did that then happen for the rest of the year and then into the spring?
Yeah, that happened all year long. I remember going over icy, snowy roads a few times, in the wintertime, because it can get, bad there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we missed any weekends that I recall.
Does anything else stand out for you as an adventure or unique things that happened there that would have been in, where are we now, in the timeline, 53 into 54? No, this would have been 52 into 53.
52 and 53, right. I don't remember too much out of the ordinary, other than the normal life, just getting through school and everything. Joe took classes that would get her ready for nurses training, and I was very much interested in the business school. So I took the shorthand and the typing and all that stuff.
What do you think attracted Joe to nursing?
I really don't know, other than our older sister, Dawn, she wanted to go into nursing.
Huh.
And whether that was part of it or what, I really don't know. But she always wanted to be a nurse also, and she was a very successful one.
Dawn was?
And Dawn was too, yeah.
Okay.
Dawn didn't really care for the nursing as much as she eventually went back to several colleges and got her degree in education, and so she became a school librarian.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Joe stuck it out for the nursing and was very successful all of her life.
Nice. What attracted you then into business?
I just like typing. I love shorthand. I didn't want any part of nursing.
Okay.
That was just that medical stuff. But I like, the desk work. I like, meeting people. And so I just love working, the paper and pencil.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the word I use again is twinage. Did you and Joe have a secret language at all? Did you communicate with?
I'm sure we had our own language. My folks couldn't understand us for quite a while.
Okay.
Yeah, from what I understand. I don't remember it, of course.
It's not uncommon between twin girls to have sort of either Pig Latin or a certain way to communicate in certain language that would sort of talk right past people.
Right. Right, and I think we were, guilty of that.
Okay. All right. So then into the summer of 1953.
Uh-huh.
I guess I should step back a minute and say, did you go ahead and finish up your high school in Gallup, I guess? What happened next?
Okay, we finished out our sophomore year in Gallup. And then at that time, my dad said, I've had enough Indian trading post work. You know, he just wasn't real happy. So my mother, being a school teacher, she started sending out applications and for teaching. And she got an offer with the Mesa Public Schools down here in Mesa, Arizona, where we are now.
Okay.
So we moved to Mesa probably July of 53.
Yeah, because the fall of 52 would have been your sophomore fall in Gallup, and then into the spring of 53, if I get this right.
Right.
And so Mom got a job in Mesa. Whoa, the big city.
Right where we're living now, of all things.
My. And so you moved there in July of 1953?
Probably July. It was hot. I remember
you
that.
Bet it was. Oh, my. Well, back in those days, air conditioning was like a canvas bag swung onto the rearview mirror of the car, and you got to drink some cool water, and that was about it.
You got that right, yeah. But my folks found a little duplex down here, and it was a one-bedroom on one side and a two-bedroom on the other. Well, we had to move into the one-bedroom because the other side was already rented or whatever. But that's when my dad started looking for jobs, and I don't know how he happened to send off applications where he did, but that's when he applied to the USGS, and he got hired with them in September of 52.
Yeah, 1953, is that right?
52. September the 11th of 1952, he started with the USGS.
Okay, so I'm a little confused. I'm going to back up a little bit here because I was thinking that he was still working in Ganado throughout the 52-53 year, sort of the fall, winter, into spring there. You were in the Albuquerque doing the band stuff. So he could have started working for GS in September of 52, but they might not have assigned him somewhere. Is that right? Or can you help me out with the timeline here?
Oh, I've got my notes here, Tom, that I made yesterday, and I've got a note that he started with USGS September the 11th of 1952, and that would have been right, because we started our junior year down here in Mesa in 52, got out in 53, our junior year.
Yeah, so freshman year finished up in Flagstaff.
Right.
Sophomore year would have been in Gallup, and junior year started in Phoenix.
Started
in Mesa. Okay, thank you. I'm just a little goofed up in my years here.
Yeah, but I am too. With all those moves,
Buzz, are you keeping track of this? Where are we at? Because it seems like your dad, your mom is really adaptable, flexible. Did she learn Navajo?
She did. She learned quite a bit of it, and
wow.
She loved it.
Wow, nice.
I didn't care if he learned any of it.
it's a very challenging language to learn, and I'm assuming it would have been a struggle for your father as well. So. But I can really appreciate why your mom would have really gotten into it and just loved it.
She did. She just loved it. She loved the Indians, and she would love to talk to them and barter with them or whatever. I think she basically ran the trading post.
Wow. Okay, so what do you remember, what were your first memories then of Mesa? And again, I'm assuming that's in July of 53, but I'm not quite sure here.
No, I think that would have been in 52, Tom. If my dad, I remember my dad. We all moved to Mesa from Ganado, and it was hot. And then he got this job with the USGS, and I've got a note that he started there. It's September the 11th, and then he took off for the Grand Canyon, for the bottom of the Grand Canyon. That was his first assignment with them.
Okay, you know what, Gay? Let's stop for a minute, and let's go back and work out this timeline.
Okay.
Because I want to make sure I could get it completely wrong here. Your summer vacation from Whitehall, the first time you guys went down to Mesa, was then in 1950.
Yeah, that was in 50.
And you guys sold out, and then that summer moved off in 1951.
Right.
Okay, and so you finished off your schooling, your freshman year in the spring of 51, with staying in Flagstaff with Buck and Betty.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So then in the fall of 51, at that point then, you're in Gallup.
Right.
Okay.
We're in Gallup. 51.
All right. So let me make sure I'm going back through this. So the Hopi band would have been in the summer of 51.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. I've got the timeline goofed up here. So then in August of 51, that was the move then out to Ganado.
Right.
Okay. And I moved in with the Italian woman, Miss Galone, then in Gallup in 1951.
51, uh-huh.
And then through into 52. There finished off then your sophomore year in 52.
52, uh-huh.
Got it. And then in 1952, then, you guys moved to Mesa.
To Mesa, you got it.
July of 52. All right. And so then your dad got a job working for the USGS in September 11th of 1952.
Right.
No, I don't think so. I just looked at his work records that we got. See, we had a decided to press a claim against the United States for the downwinder, the radiation exposure.
Yes.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We were successful in doing that. Mm-hmm. And it appears like he first went to work for the USGS. I'm looking at a ream of paper. It's a typical government thing.
Yep.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
September 11th of 52.
That's what it's
Yay! I love this kind of history when all the stars align.
I feel sorry for you, Tom, with all this.
No, this is wonderful, and it's so easy, as you can see, for me to get dates wrong, and then suddenly I'm like, "Well, wait a minute, what year is this? Let's go back and figure it out." So,
hey, with all these news, I can't keep it straight, and I was there.
Well, thank you. This is very. I appreciate that, Buzz, and of course, thank you, Gay. To figure out that timeline and how that would have worked out. okay, so it would seem to me that your dad got an assignment to Phantom Ranch in the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Uh-huh.
In the fall there of 1952, and he would have just disappeared.
Right. Yeah, he left us, and of course, he said, "I'm going to the bottom of the Grand Canyon." We didn't know what that was or where it was.
Right. So at one point now, pretty soon, you're going to get your first glimpse of Grand Canyon.
Right.
And tell me about that.
Okay, he went down there, like I say, in September, and of course, we corresponded with him as much as you could when he's in the bottom. But our first vacation would have been, I believe, Christmas time, when our first time we went down after, we had a Christmas vacation from high school. Mother was out of teaching. I don't think we went down there for Thanksgiving. But anyway, we went down that Christmas of 52.
Hang on, before we get there, I'm sorry, I'm just going to back up a bit. And I'm assuming that job at the bottom of the canyon is an everyday job. It's kind of like life back at the creamery. You've got
right.
to collect that data every day, and so did your father get a chance to come home and see you guys at all that fall?
No, he did not.
Oh, okay.
No, The only time we got to see him is when we went to see him.
Right. Okay.
Right. The 7-day-a-week job.
Yeah. Okay. So it's Christmas 1952. You and Joe and your mom are you and Joe are out of school. It's a Christmas break. Your mom's not teaching. And you guys drive up all the way up to. You were familiar with Flagstaff. Did you connect the dots then? Okay, here's Flagstaff, and Dad's kind of up north. I know where Flagstaff is.
Yeah, we knew where Flagstaff was, and my mom drove us because we weren't driving. I don't remember if we went through Williams to get to the Grand Canyon or we went the back way through Flagstaff.
Okay.
To be honest with you. But I know we got up there and arrived at and stayed at the Bright Angel Hotel.
Okay.
And it was late in the afternoon, I remember, and we walked in, we had a room there, and these two young boys came up to us, and, to my mother, and said, "We'd like to take your girls to the movies tonight." So, and of course, we didn't know anybody, but she said, okay. She thought it was a small enough community and everything.
Uh-huh.
But One of the boys, was his name was Sam Turner. His dad ran the
no kidding.
Yeah, his dad ran the train station there.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard his name. And then I can't remember the other guy. It was Eddie somebody. But they didn't have any money, so they borrowed money from a young man by the name of Donald Shellbach.
Oh, my gosh.
Who's a bellhop there. And he loaned them the money to take us to the movies.
What do you remember about that evening with Sam Turner?
Oh, it was fun. Of course, we didn't know where we were or what we were doing, but it was fun. I don't know what movie we saw, but they were very polite young men.
Uh-huh.
Brought us home after the movie back to the motel, and then we got up the next morning, and I believe we rode mules down the Grand Canyon that time.
Yep. Tell me about that.
Yeah. We've never been on a mule. And it was kind of scary, to be honest with you. But we rode this mule train down, and I think that was about the only time we ever rode the mule. After that, we hiked.
Okay.
Did all the hikes. So, but anyway, we got up the next morning, like I say, rode the mules down, and I don't remember too much. I know I thought we were right there at Phantom Ranch when we saw my dad, and we crossed the river, the Colorado River, on the suspension bridge, and off to the left as you go across the bridge were this little house and whatever, and that was where my dad was stationed at the U.S. Geological Survey property. And so anyway, I don't remember now how it all worked out, but Phantom Ranch was a mile on further up the road,
uh-huh.
The trail.
Yep.
So anyway, but we spent the whole Christmas vacation there, had a wonderful time. My mother there again got acquainted with the owners or the runners, managers of the Phantom Ranch, and my dad had already gotten acquainted with everybody.
So,
and then just to the west of his property was the, I think it was a Park Service house. And there was a man living there, a guy, it wasn't a ranger, I can't remember what, but he had something to do with the Park Service.
So let's back up a minute. So Phantom Ranch at that time, this is going to be, I get my timeline right here, this is the winter of 1952-1953, and I believe that would have been Slim and Dottie Patrick.
That's who it was, Slim and Dottie.
And what do you remember about them?
Oh, they were wonderful people, very happy-go-lucky, very caring, very helpful. They thought the world of my dad, and I have a feeling he probably spent a lot of evenings up there with them visiting or maybe having meals. I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they were both wonderful, wonderful people, and would give you the shirt off of that.
Nice. Wow. Can you describe them at all?
Slim was just a real tall, slender guy. I think more on the blondish, maybe gray hair, but he was very tall and slim. Dottie was a little on the heavy-duty side. Wonderful cook. And she took us, Joe and I again, and, you know, all of us, and mother too, under her wing. And of course, she and my mother, you know, took up an immediate friendship.
Nice.
Yeah, and but they were very nice people, very helpful.
Did you get a sense that your father had was he happier at Phantom? I mean, so he, it's kind of frying pan to the fire. He's not real happy with the trading post operations, but at least he's a little closer to his family. Now he's working this remote station in the bottom of Grand Canyon. The friends are nice, but his family's like, you know, 200 miles away. Did you get a sense, talking with your father later on in life, did he ever explain what he was thinking during those days?
I think he was very happy there. I think he was lonely. I think he missed my mom.
Uh-huh, sure.
And but he was happy with his job, happy where he lived. He loved it. And he had to hike out once a month with reports for the government. I don't know why he had to hike them. I don't know why he didn't put them on a mule, but anyway, he had to come out once a month, which I think was good for him to get a break.
And how would he work out his groceries? Did he eat up at the ranch with Slim and Dottie? How did that work for him? Do you know?
I think he got a lot of his groceries on the mule train.
Okay.
And then I have a feeling, I don't know, but I have a feeling he ate a lot of mules up there with Slim and Dottie.
Okay.
And they were just that kind of people. They would say, come on up and have dinner or have lunch or whatever. But I think he would cook for himself, too, breakfast and whatever. But he loved his job. He just dearly loved the outdoors and going across the Colorado on the cable car and with his fish and getting his water samples and coming home and baking the mud pies in his lab.
So let's gosh, now I got a zillion questions. I got a zillion questions for you now. Let's see, how do I want to work this out? Because I'm interested in the fish. What kind of fish was he catching out of the river?
Well, actually, they called it a fish, but it was just a big metal container that looked like a fish. Lead container, was it, Buzz?
No, I'm sorry. Gay, hang on a second, because way back when you were growing up in Montana, your father loved to hunt and fish.
Yes.
And yes, I'm aware that there's a fish, there's this aluminum thing that you drop out of the cable car. You're going to tell me all about that later. But one of the things that kind of perked me up right away in that your dad did love to fish, there would have been trout in Bright Angel Creek, but there would have been a unique subset of fish in the Colorado River. And your dad, as a fisherman, he might have not spent any time fishing in the main stem, but he might have spent a lot of time up in Bright Angel fishing up there. So can you fill me in on that?
You know, I don't remember him saying too much about fishing the Bright Angel. He probably did a little bit, but I don't think it was to the degree that he fished in Montana.
Okay.
That I recall. And I don't think he fished at all in Colorado that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So then let's talk about what you remember of his duties then, because you mentioned the mud cakes and the fish, the steel kind of fin, sort of a teardrop almost kind of thing that had a good weight to it, might have weighed 30 or 40 pounds. What can you tell me about that operation?
It was a Navy operation, and as I understand, and there again, I was young, didn't pay all that much of attention, which I kick myself for now.
No worries.
But he would have to go across the Colorado every day on this cable car and drop the fish into certain areas or wherever he thought he needed to.
He was collecting water samples.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He was collecting water samples in milk bottles, but they were inside the fish. And then he would, and then measure the flow of the Colorado River on the gauging station. And he would do this at least one time a day, maybe two times a day. But then he would take these water samples out of the metal fish that were in his milk bottles. And he had a lab, not in the house where he lived, but attached pretty close to it. And it had a bake oven, of sorts. I don't know, probably on propane. And he would, you know, do whatever they did to the water.
And actually just, he'd put the water samples in something like a Petri dish and put them in the oven and evaporate all of the water and then measure the leftover sediment so they could get an idea of how much of the river water was dirt.
So, Buzz and Gay, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about this so I understand it. The sediment that would be left in the Petri dish, would then that get weighed? Because you'd know the constant weight of the Petri dish, and then if you could figure out the weight of the sediment in the dish, and you knew the volume of water in the dish, you could calculate the suspended sediment in the water. Is that right?
All I know is his procedure was to take the milk bottle sample, put it in a container, a Petri dish or something like that, and basically boil the water out and then measure the amount of sediment, probably, well, I don't know, maybe it was volume or weight. It could have been volume.
Well, yeah, it would have, exactly. I mean, if you know then the weight of the dirt, you know how much dirt is going by. As a volume of dirt, right? I mean, because you know this much water has this much dirt. And then if I have a whole river full of water, I have more dirt, and I can figure out how much that is.
I would guess that's correct, yes.
So let's go back for a minute, because I'm slowly learning as I do these interviews a little bit more about that operation and how it worked. But I think, especially because you guys, you were so close to it, Gay, with your dad doing the work there. The milk bottles, did you notice they have little numbers on them? And did you also notice that on the cable there were little marks, and your dad would stop the cable where the marks were, and they corresponded to the marks on the milk bottles, and the fish would go down and come back with water, which would go in that milk bottle?
Boy, I don't know, Tom.
I don't either. I know that the cable was marked.
Right.
But I don't know what the correlation was between that and the milk bottles. But what you're saying makes sense, because probably the volume would vary based upon the speed of the water and what was rolling along on the bottom as well.
That's right. The suspended sediment load based on what was happening with the weather upstream, weather events would throw more or less sediment into the river. Yeah, I'm putting all this together. This is great because I just did some interview work with Shirley Patrick. So Shirley told me about the time she went across with your dad, and she gave me some of this story too. So now putting these two stories together, I'm like, oh, well, that was how it was happening.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of fun. The fish, I'm assuming there was a way your dad could open the fish up to capture the water and then close it and then bring it back up. Do you remember that at all?
You would put the empty bottle in the fish, close the front of the fish opened up, and you set the milk bottle in, and it would have been horizontal to the fish and therefore able to draw the water through an opening in the front of the fish.
Yep.
The water and sediment. And it would depend also how far into the water he would measure. I mean, he would drop the thing.
Yes.
In other words, as the fish reached the surface of the water, then he would drop it another distance, based on a measured distance, so that he, because, you know, I guess mainly the sediment is greater in certain layers of the stream, I would assume.
Sure. As a turbid stream, it'd be a little less right near the surface, and a little more down a little deeper. Do you remember how that fish opened and closed when it was underwater?
It opened right from the front. I'm looking at a picture of one now out of a National Geographic that we have.
Okay.
It's the May 1955 version. This time I'm looking at not Dean, but his predecessor, I think. And the thing, it looked more, not as much like a fish as it did a bomb.
Right, like a bomb that would be dropped out of a plane.
Right. It had a high dorsal fin on the back, and horizontal stabilizers on the side, and a vertical fin on the bottom. I suppose that kept it from twisting in the water thing. But now the front. Your question was how did the fish open up? I'm looking at this photo, and the door is open, and it looked like there's about the milk bottle would go in. Well, it would have to go in the full length of the milk bottle. Then this thing, it's all made of lead, so it's heavier than the very devil. And then you would close the lid or the front of the fish, and it would kind of, I think it looks like there might have been a little gasket or something around it, so it would close and put all of the, would close up the water bottle entirely, and then you close the window, the lid was closed. It would actually, it would completely encompass the bottle. The bottle was inside the thing, and it looked like it might be about 3 or 4 inches back from the front of the fish, or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, so I can think of a simple concept. If I had a hole in the top of the fish, I would put the bottle in there. The bottle's empty. I would close the little door. And then I would drop this thing pretty quickly down to the desired depth and then let it sit there while the air bubbled out of the milk bottle and the water bubbled in. And then I would reel the thing back up and it would be full of liquid. And then I could turn the fish on its side and open it up and pull out a milk bottle full of muddy water.
That's precisely, I think, what happened. It couldn't be totally horizontal, but it was on an angle, maybe about a 30-degree angle. I'm looking at this picture, and it looks like the angle would be about 25-30 degrees.
Okay.
And then you could open the lid and pull the water bottle out.
And so with a lot of samples to be taken, I mean, it's a fairly wide chunk of river right there. Dean would have been fairly busy during the day. He'd had to gone out, get his samples. He'd had to get those samples back to the lab. He would then have to deal with the prior day's samples, get them weighed out, and get the new samples into the oven, keep the data records going. I can see there's a good amount of time during the day there that he would have had to work on the equipment, make sure the maintenance was up on things, and to write his reports. Okay, we're just trying to get an idea of what his day would have been like there.
Yeah. If you have an opportunity to get a hold of the May 1955 National Geographic, page 612 is where all this is depicted.
Thank you. I'll look for that. Okay. You have been so most generously kind. We have been at this about an hour and a half, and as you can see, we have not gotten very far.
I think you've done amazing, Tom.
Oh, my gosh. You're the amazing one. Both of you, thank you so very much for this incredible journey. I would like to end this interview here, but before I do, I've learned to ask, is there anything else that you were thinking right now that needed to go into this last little bit we were talking about?
I can't think of anything off the top, Tom.
Buzz, you?
No, I'm kind of addled now.
Okay. Please stay on the phone here, but I'm going to wrap up this interview. Today is Monday, December 4th, 2017. This is the end of part one, Grand Canyon Oral History with Gay Cameron. That's Barbara Gay Tidball Cameron and Buzz Cameron. Her husband, that's Kenneth Lincoln Cameron. My name's Tom Martin. And so we're going to end part one right now.